Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Episode 20, Fall into Winter. Hello everyone, my name is Kevin England and I want to welcome you to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. It's nice to be behind the microphone again after a bit of a layoff. I've got a little bit of a cold today, but that's not going to stand in our way as the topics for the podcast are piling up around here, and we've got a full show for you this time around. In this episode, I had a chance to sit in on a presentation in mid-September on the topic of pesticides and CCD. The speaker was Mary Ann Frazier from Penn State. I'm going to hit the highlights and give you a heads up as to where you can pull down and listen to the whole conversation. Like spring hive management, fall has activities all of their own. Are you ready to fall into winter? I'll give you a preview of the practices we follow around this neck of the woods. A friend of mine asked me about how to shortcut the process for moving bees from one location to another. I'll share what we talked about. Are you seeing some supersized visitors at your hive? What exactly are they? We'll talk about the discovery of a nearby European hornet hive. Weather know-how? We've had a record-breaking summer here in the Northeast with all of the rain, and I've been joking with those who live around here that it seems like we live in Seattle. I'll share some of the musings on the potential impacts, and we'll have a little good of the order to close out the episode. Before I get to the local hive report, I wanted to share one thing about this episode. I'm going to make a little bit of a change. Typically what I do to break up the section is play a little bit of music. For this one, what I'm going to try and do is just put a little bit of a chime or a time or some sort of piece. I haven't produced the episode yet, so I'm not sure what it is, to break between the topics. It should make the show move a little quicker and is a little less intensive for me to try and find music for every episode. We'll see how that sounds. If it doesn't work, we'll go back to the other part because part of the fun was indeed picking the music out, but it's a little bit burdensome, so just a little programming note here before we carry through the episode. I have three hives on the property, and it's time for the local hive report. All three hives are operating fine. A lot of activity right now as the goldenrod is out. You see the bees bringing back a lot of pollen. Haven't been inside the hives as life has overtaken not only the podcast, but the ability to get in and check on them. Did do a little maintenance over the past weekend, gave them some honey supers, as you'll hear me talk throughout this episode, and also did a little fall rearrangement on hive number one. It actually didn't go as planned, as you will see if you wanted to check it out. Shot a video. My son Daniel helped me with that. Came out pretty well. Showed frames and what was inside the hive. We did a little rearrangement. With weather coming in and probably my lack of good skill at rearranging the boxes, they got a little perturbed with me, got stung a couple times. Not that that's an amusing side effect, but if you're interested, you could check that out. Have a new YouTube channel with a bunch of our videos going up there, and I've been copying them up just about one a day until I exhaust the inventory. You could check that out, youtube.com/NWNJBA. Putting several of our videos up, including how to do a hive inspection. One of my podcasts recently was the audio one. This is the video one where you see me give this talk at our spring or summer association meeting. Also up there is a bunch of videos on how to do a sugar shake and several other speakers there, including how to arrange your hives for fall management. So the local hive report, the bees are doing fine. Everything is in good order. I do need to get in and make sure that they have the proper stores. After looking at what was in hive number one, I know they have some honey up on the top, but again, it's time to reiterate to everybody what you need here. You want to have your brood in the box, at least four frames. They should be building their winter bees. If you did not treat for Varroa, shame on you, but get to it right now is about the last vestige you have to clear that out and possibly build those bees so that they can get a big enough cluster to overwinter. You're going to take those bees, hopefully at least four frames, give them enough pollen and honey stores that they can survive the winter and make it over to spring without any intervention from you, the beekeeper. As you'll hear me say in the episode a little bit later, it's always a good idea to check out the Marek Fall Management Guide. That being the case, let's go into our number one feature. I wanted to have a discussion about the symposium put on by the Bucks County Beekeepers Association and the talk given by Marion Fraser. If you're not familiar with Marion Fraser, she's a senior extension associate at the Department of Entomology at Penn State University and was speaking at the invitation of the Bucks County Beekeepers Association at the Delaware Valley College in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Marianne is working closely with Dr. Chris Mullen and her husband, Dr. Jim Fraser, on the potential role of pesticides on declining honeybee health in general and with CCD specifically. The topic of the conversation that night was pollinators and pesticides and the research being done by Penn State along with how to protect your honeybee colonies. I arrived to the symposium just a little bit late because of being delayed at work, and when I arrived, Marianne was already talking about their visits to Kenya. They were interested in that region of the world because of the fact that they were known to have less disease and lack of pesticide use throughout the countryside, and also there were claims that there were no varroa in the hives. That turned out to be inaccurate based on their assessments, but the team did note that the hives did not have many viruses in that area. What they were specifically excited about was the fact that the contamination of the wax was non-existent. In the United States, almost all the wax that we have, that we purchase from Foundation, or in the hives that we've had over time, are contaminated with Kumafos and fluvalinate, and there they have pristine comb. So much so that they were looking to work with the Kenyans to harvest the comb and bring it back to the United States for different studies and other reasons. The Kenyans themselves did not use the comb for any purpose, no candles, no wax, anything. They just basically discard it. There is a program they were putting together to sponsor a wax melting program where they would send over the hardware and the resources required to fabricate the devices in exchange for getting clean wax back. It's something that's a work in progress, and they would be happy to have people sponsor that program. You could contact Marianne if you're interested in that. Getting on to the pesticide lecture, really what they were looking at is how the bees are becoming exposed to pesticides and exactly how much pesticide are they coming in contact with and what's the impacts of them. They were looking for about 171 different profiles of pesticides, and out of those they found 121 present in the samples that they collected. They reviewed something greater than 1,000 samples along with some of the personal studies that they were doing, like an apple orchard study. They found that the bees are not only going to the crops that are being treated, but they're also going to non-typical products like corn and soybean that you wouldn't think they're getting to. Only 7% of the 1,100 samples lacked detections of some sort of chemical or pesticide. Up to 39 pesticides have been found in a single sample. 6 pesticides on average for every sample. Let me repeat that again, because that's just a scary number. Of the hives that had pesticides present, there were at least 6 on average in each one of those hives. Marianne profiled the different pesticides that were found in the hives and the amounts and quantities. A lot of people were interested in the neonicotinoids. They were 14 times in 836 samples. Not a huge percentage, but what she did discover is that when they were in the hives, they were at parts per billion or at a concentration that was above the lethal dose. Kumafos and fluvalinate apparently are the most prevalent in all of these. Kumafos was found in 668 of the 887 samples, or 75% of them. Fluvalinate was found in 80% plus. It's really interesting that we use those to treat mites way back when, and they have a shelf span of at least 5 years, and according to both Jennifer Berry and Marianne Fraser, these things are hanging around and in our wax. Conclusions: yes, pesticides are present in quaternions to be consideration for beekeepers as far as the health and wellness of the hive. The pyrethroids dominated. And again, I could go into all this, but I'm really not going to. What I'll do is I'll provide you a link. You can go and listen to the details of this. You know, to me, again, the striking part was 6 pesticides for each hive, and the concentrations that were in there were really alarming in many aspects of it. The one thing that came to question, and this has been asked in previous sessions that I've been a part of, but nobody really knew the answer, and Marianne actually covered it, is what about honey? Now, wax and the pollen are both high in fat and will absorb the pesticides very readily, but honey is a different makeup, and what they did is they had to sample the honey to make sure it was safe to consume. She discussed that the government collected 744 samples from grocery stores, farmers markets, and various pieces. The findings, a small sample of pesticides were found in all of the products, 12 pesticides identified in total. Cumafos was in 35% of the samples, but only at 1 part per billion. The analogy they use there is if you took 1 grain of salt in a 5-gallon jar or rolled toilet paper from New York to London, it would be the equivalent of 1 sheet of toilet paper. We're talking about really small amounts. There is a concern, however, based on what she had said, about honey that's sold with comb or even selling pollen to the public. There are agencies out there that will scan your honey, scan your pollen, and make sure that they're safe for consumption. And I'm not going to say it's the recommendation, but if you're consuming these things, given the amount of pesticides that they're finding in these, I guess it just would be prudent to say that. Another interesting aspect of pesticides that I had never considered, Marianne was talking about the synergistic sideline that happens with the inert ingredients or ingredients that are concocted in these formulas that these companies are putting in. Now, the regulatory agencies are certifying these pesticides to go out into public, and most of them have an active ingredient. Sometimes these active ingredients have become tolerant to the targets that they have, and in order to soup them up a little bit, they're adding inert ingredients which synergize with the original component and make it that much stronger. The inert ingredients are not under subject of review. As it was discussed, it is probable or possible that some of these inert ingredients are as damaging to the honeybee population and other insects as the actual active ingredient, but because they're added as a side effect of the concoction, it may be possible that they're slipping under the radar. All of these things could be suspect to the overall health of the colony as they are penetrates into the wax and into the environments where the bees live. I guess the takeaway on this is that there is more to be said about the pesticides, and they'll continue to do research on it. Marianne, working with her husband Jim, Chris Mullen, Dr. Mullen, and Sarah Ashcraft, are a part of the Managed Pollinator Coordinated Agricultural Project, led and chaired by Dr. Keith Delaplane. They will continue to look at this, but you could tell by the conversation that they have a lot of work to do. Between the pesticides and the way they break down, how they impact the bees, and the sublethal dose component of it that they have no idea whether that's really the impact for CCD or whether it's something else. They're gaining on it, but there's still a lot of work to do. Really what it seems to me, and this is now my opinion digestion of what was talked about, is there's just enough pesticides and exterior components being carried in by the bees, who do that very well, by the way, into the environment to make it like a sick home. Stressed bees from being moved all over, if it's in the commercial, or being managed improperly, whether it's the hobby beekeeper, along with these environments and the mites, are really causing the overall challenges. And I'm not alone in those thoughts. A lot of people have expressed those, so they're not revelationary, but boy, I tell you, it's going to be an interesting couple years as they continue to do the research on this. The second component of the discussion was how to protect your bees, and obviously some of the first topics were controlling the Varroa. Resistant stock, IPM, like drone removal, and doing powdered sugar treatments, use of soft chemicals, the new formic acid formulations for Mitaway Quick Strips, Apigard, Apolife Var, and very big in something that we've talked about several times on this podcast, recycle your comb. Get rid of the stuff that is saturated. I am really sitting on the fence as to whether or not I am going to use foundation any further. I have a friend who doesn't do it, and I think I'm going to take the extra mile to wire those frames so that the bees could build their own, and I could spin it out without having to use the Cumafos and fluvalinate-laden foundations that you purchase. Another topic that she touched upon, and I thought it was interesting to share, was reporting pesticides incidents. There is an incident reporting website. It's pi.ace.orst.edu/EREP. We'll provide that for our notes. There is a procedure that you call them first, and then they provide you with the information to log into a website and log the incident. What Marianne was sharing is that people are having incidents, they're managing them locally, or they don't want to offend the grower who sprayed the bees that killed the colony that the commercial guy was putting in, and he doesn't want to ruin his revenue stream. So nothing gets reported, it's all kept under the rug, and the regulatory agencies don't necessarily see a problem. You know, quite frankly, this is not productive for the beekeepers, and she was basically pleading for beekeepers to be transparent about these issues. We've got nothing to hide and we should be reporting them. She also touched upon the Center for Pollinator Research and a program they're having to look at homeowner pesticide use. There's a pilot to start this fall to see what pesticide loads are away from agricultural centers. They hope to demonstrate to homeowners the problems they're causing by the pesticides that they're applying on their properties. She related an interesting story, too, about Roundup, which somebody asked a question, and it was the fact that one beekeeper, whom she was aware of, had two containers on carts. One had Roundup in it, one had sugar water that they sprayed on the bees. One time he made a mistake, sprayed the bees with Roundup, not knowing it wasn't the sugar water, and the bees actually survived the situation. The farmer next door to me told me at one point he was going to spray Roundup, and I looked into it, and it always seemed to be innocuous based on what I saw from the web. That's about as proof as can be, at least in one situation, that if you could spray the stuff directly on the bees and they did not die, perhaps Roundup is not something we should get overly excited about. The talk ended with a question and answer session, and one of the comments were, how are the systemics getting into the hive? Marianne disclosed that originally the systemics, or the neonicotinoids in particular, were originally supposed to be put on the seeds and in the ground. The thinking was that if in the ground, the highly toxic pesticide would not be exposed to the bees. Now it is probable that sometimes they're spraying it literally on the trees, or it's exuding through the moisture on the plants or the pollen itself. Commercial beekeepers are providing anecdotal evidence about something is going on, but they cannot literally find the science to draw the conclusion. As I said, it sounds like there's more work to do, and we can count on the team from the Managed Pollinator CAP to keep us posted on that. And there was an update recently from the Coordinated Agricultural Project in the August issue of Bee Culture, which I have here in front of me in my hands, and also the American Bee Journal. That article, Pesticides and CCD, is also available on the extension.org website, and we'll post a link to it in our show notes. I wanted to thank Marianne for coming out and talking to the beekeepers in the community, and also the Bucks County Beekeepers Association for coming out and giving the talk. Again, if you want to listen to it, we are going to have a sidebar episode posted shortly right after this one where you can pick up and listen to the entire conversation. Turned into the driveway coming home from work the other night, noticed leaves all over the driveway. The occasional leaves on the driveway is not a concern, but this was leaves like falling out of the trees, which means fall has arrived, and we've reached one of those trigger points that a beekeeper looks for in the year.
much like the dandelions blooming in the spring means it's time to get the hives going for nectar flow. To me, when I see leaves on the ground in the driveway, that is the indication that it's time to get ready for fall preparation. And it is not a time to procrastinate, as July and August are done. It's September time frame. You have treated for your mites, and now it's time to get your hive set up for winter configuration. And what always happens here is that you mean to get to it, and the weekends pass, and then all of a sudden, you find yourself where it's too cold to go into the box, and you're out there hoping for a warm day to sneak in and get yourself set up. Making myself not procrastinate, I went out this past weekend to try and do hive setups with my boxes. And actually shot a video with my son Daniel and tried to configure the box for fall setup. Now, I don't know if this is a practice that's done everywhere or whether it's just something that we do, but it's something that I learned in the beginning, and it's something that I know some of the members in our club does. So let me explain this for a bit. And this is not unique to our area. It was something published, I'm assuming, in Bee Culture magazine and also published on the internet and is widely known. The premise of this is not too different from the spring configuration, where you take the brood and you put it down in the bottom of the box so that then they can move up as the nectar flow comes and feel like they have room to grow, versus having them right up against the inner cover and getting that sensation that they want to swarm because they're crowded. In the fall time, you take the brood if they're in the top deep, and we run two deep configurations here in New Jersey, and you move the brood down to the center chamber of the bottom box. You surround them with honey and pollen, presumably pollen right to their outside so that they could feed the brood, mixed with some honey so they have some stores close by in case they need it if it gets cold. But one of the critical things here is that you take a full frame of honey and you put it to the outside of the bottom box on both sides. The reason for that is, as it starts to cool off and the bees have to maintain that cluster in order to stay warm, they can move side to side and be able to obtain a full box of honey to the right or left, and also the food they need to maintain the brood through the winter months. Now, subsequently, what you have is about 2 to 4 frames of brood, and that number varies depending on who you're talking to at this time of year. And the bees are making their winter bees, but they get down to their winter weight, so to speak, and the number of bees that they feel they need to winter over. And then they'll survive with the brood down in the bottom chamber with honey and pollen to their sides, and honey dome across them. So you want at least 9 frames of honey up above them. And what will happen in time is, as they need it, they will move up into the box. And then in the springtime, they'll be up in the box and they can move right or left until the weather breaks and they can get out and forage again. Difficult to describe, easy to review when you look at a diagram or you look at the video that we produced describing this topic. If you want to see how that works, you can go to the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers homepage. I have something posted over there right now. And after that, if you're listening to this someday late in the future, you could probably go to the videos page. The information will be available out there to you. nwba.njbeekeepers.org is that web address. And I'm sure I'll repeat that sometime in the near future through this podcast. But there's a picture of or a link to the document that's the source. And I forgot what the source is, but we'll have a link to that in our show notes. And also there's a diagram there, a picture in that shows you the hive configuration through the seasonal management, and especially for fall. In addition, there's some photos associated with that on the homepage, and the video of Stan Wazatowski from SNF Honey Farms talking about how to reconfigure your box using a demo box for fall. So check that out. nwba.njbeekeepers.org is the website where you can get that content. There's also the Merrick Fall Management Guide that I would recommend to everybody up here in the Northeast. In the Mid-Atlantic, the Merrick is usually the best guide to follow. I had a coworker contact me the other day and ask me a question that he was struggling with his hive. He's a new beekeeper, started this year, and I had talked to him a couple weeks ago and he told me that he was looking to move his hive to a different location. He had received advice that he had to move the hive no more than 2 feet every day or the bees would get confused, and he was actually going through that ritual, but explained to me in an email that he is now at a point where he needs to move the hive and that's all there is to it. He has some trucks or something that have to drive through the area where the hive is, and he wanted to know if I knew of any shortcuts. It's not something I've been faced with, but I did understand that there was this kind of lament that said, 2 feet or 2 miles, nothing in between. And typically what you'd hear is somebody say, you pack your hive up for the evening, take it away somewhere 2 miles, and then eventually you would bring it back. And I don't believe that was an option he was looking for. So to the web for research I went, and I found an article or several forum posts that eventually led back to an article from Michael Bush from Bush's Bees. And basically it said, you can try this technique, which is to move the hive to a current from the current location to a future location, but do something that changes the perspective of the bees as to where they're located. Here's the procedure that I talked about. The first thing you do is at some point you seal those bees up and you move them to the new location and you keep them confined for at least 3 days or 72 hours, I think it said. And then once that's done, the bees will have been sufficiently combined to realize that something is up. The next procedure is to take branches, bushes, leaves, something, and put it over top of the hive entrance so that as the bees emerge, they have to either work their way out or work through something that was never there before, and it triggers a mechanism in the bees that something else has happened. Another suggestion was that you could potentially change the entrance to the hive so that they come out in a different orientation. And orientation is the key word. The point here is that should they have to work their way out and recognize something is wrong, they would come out and reorient themselves to the sun and to the hive location in their new position, and that should technically solve the problem and move them in one fell swoop. Now, the $1 million question is, what if you didn't bother to do that? What if you just pick the hive up, close it up one night, picked it up, moved it somewhere, left it for a couple of days, and opened it up and let them go? In theory, what they say is the bees will go out to forage, and then they would come back to that hive location and try and find a suitable home. For my friend, the question I posed to him is, where is your closest hive? For if he is going to try this, perhaps where he's moving it to, and he said something about 50 feet or so, maybe they would come back to that original location, not find it, and end up in the new location because the hive is the closest thing, even though he's moved it away. In the suggested article, and I read it probably last week sometime, I think what it said was that you could put an empty box at that location, let the bees collect in it because they would not know what to do, and then take them over and dump them into the hive as you did it until everybody figured out a home. Now, the important thing for him here is that it's late September, and you don't want to lose bees at this juncture because you need your bees for overwintering. He has to be careful, but he has to make a decision. If I were him, I'd go for it and see what happens. What do you stand but to learn something in the process? And based on the articles I've seen, it seems that the procedure that Bush had come up with, or at least he had the instructions for, appears to work based on some of the feedback I've seen. So an interesting dilemma. If you know some way that this should be done and you want to suggest it to the listeners, give us a ring or send us an email, kevin@bkcorner.org. And remember, whenever you send information to us,
Make sure you tell us your name, where you're from, and how to pronounce your name if it's difficult.
I was talking to a fellow beekeeper last week about how things were going with his hives. And we were talking about some of the robbing that goes on this time of year, especially since there doesn't seem to be that big of a nectar flow going on. And one of the things I've noticed is wasps and yellow jackets, which are a form of a wasp, always at the hive. And what he had mentioned to me is he's starting to see some of these really big, big wasps. And what I thought was possibly it was cicada killers. We have them here in New Jersey, and the cicadas were out here through the middle of August and into early September. And I've actually caught one. It was floating in the pool when I pulled it out. It's really, really cool. It's like a giant bee wasp looking thing with menacing stinger on it. And he said, no, it didn't. The way he described it, it was a little bit different. Well, lo and behold, Sharon was walking down the road the other day, and in the base of a tree that had a hole, she found a wasp nest. And in it were these really big wasps. And I went and I took a picture of them and shot a little video, and we did a little research. And what they are is European hornets. They have to be 1.5 inches to almost 2 inches long. They're yellow, very fierce looking. When they fly by you, they sound like a fighter jet. I was brave enough to stand at the hive, but zoomed in on them with the camera. And, you know, as you look at it, I guess they're one of those creatures that eats grasshoppers, bugs, and they do eat bees, according to a website. Thought that was pretty cool. If you happen to see these gargantuan wasps here in the Northeast and up and down, I guess, the Northeast seaboard, I guess it's referred to as, but I guess they'll go over as far as Indiana here in the United States. I'll have to put a link to the website I found that showed a little bit about them and their territory, but whatever the case may be, very cool, and we'll have some pictures of those posted up on our website for you to take a peek at. So if you're seeing some big visitors, could be European hornets coming to see you. Sometimes you get yourself into a chicken and egg situation. You want to put a podcast out. You have the content prepared. But content comes in a package. It's stuff that you talk about, and you have to have the supporting information underneath it. Take the Marion Fraser conversation. I was able to record Marion, and I think the recording lets you listen to her full talk without my bias on it and draw your own conclusions. I do like to sum up some of that because people don't particularly want to have to listen through an entire recording, but some people do have the opportunity to drive to work or to listen to a podcast at the gym and listen to what they have to say, and they want to hear it for their own ears. I like to afford both of those options, but sometimes it's at the cost of the podcast. In this case, I don't particularly like to talk about something and not provide the audio to go with it or promise it at a later date. If it's good enough information, I'll put it out there, but in this case, it feels like it should be part of a package. Now comes the chicken and egg situation. How do you put the podcast out without having the audio done? I guess the answer is sometimes the topic has to wait, and there are certain topics that can wait and get presented when they're available, but I really like to get the information out in a timely manner. I don't want to be talking or presenting something that happened in July or June here on a September podcast. But I guess, you know, to each his own of how they do it, but that's just a little inside peek at some of the challenges of trying to produce this. And I don't know, you know, I guess a couple weeks is acceptable and we'll put it together, but I've recorded a couple different segments for this podcast between the last one and this one, and sometimes they're just not up to snuff. Sometimes I didn't do a good job at portraying what I want, and I won't put it out there. A little bit finicky, but I'd rather give you a good view of the topic at hand versus just glassing it over. I know I said in the past that I would try and do some of these side bites, and I think I'm going to do that. I purchased a new or received a new recorder, and should be able to do some small one-off little tidbits and put them out there like this. So let's see how things go in the future for beekeeping. Thanks. It's time for a couple things that fall under good of the order. As I drive to work right now, and as it has been for the last 3 weeks, it is so foggy here you could hardly see in front of you. I'm following a bus, which is about 2 telephone poles distance to me, and I can just make out the back end of the bus as it stops to pick up children. It has been really, really wet here in New Jersey since the hurricane passed through and since the tropical storm. We've been stuck in this pattern where the ground is saturated, the air is saturated, and we just can't seem to get a break. What I haven't seen, too, is an abundance of sunny days to come and dry anything out. That showed up this past weekend when I did a hive inspection and I stuck the hive tool between the two boxes. As I started to pry, it literally squeezed water out of the wood. Now the million-dollar question is, what does this mean to the bees? I don't know the answer. I was just reading an article in Bee Culture where it said people don't take observations of what's going on in their area. One of the things I thought was really fascinating in there was that it said that the bees, or more likely the trees, are affected by the moisture, meaning the more moisture they can get into their roots this year means more sugar water next year for the tree. Well, if it's any sign this year, they've gotten more than their share of water. I'd say some of them have to be totally saturated. But when you look at the growth rings through the trees and the cambium, this is definitely a year for moisture and sugar water. The second thing pondering on my brain is, this past weekend I put some honey supers up on the box for hive 2 and 3, and hive 1 had a honey super on it with some stores in it left over from the springtime. My hope and want and desire is that the bees will actually pull this down into the main chamber, but the question is, what if they don't? Do I leave these on over winter? I'm not exactly experienced in that, because the last several years I've fed my bees because we didn't have any nectar float to speak of. So this year, I actually have an excess of honey that I'm trying to give back to them. And I'm not sure that they'll pull it in or just consider it part of the actual hive. And I guess, why would I worry about 3 boxes versus 2 going into fall? I would worry in one context, from a heat standpoint, if they left the stores up above, it's too far for them to break cluster and come up and get. Whereas if it were in the top dome right above them, then you'd be good to go. But the thing about this is that the honey super is a medium. It is not a full box. Could you take the medium frames and put them out? I don't know. Ideally, what would happen is the bees would transfer it all down into the box. But I guess I'm going to have to ask this question next week or this weekend when I get to the beekeepers meeting, what people will tell me with that. The other option I thought about was that I could just take these supers and put them out in the yard and let the bees rob them, which would work. I don't know. I guess I'm going to have to find the answer, and when I do, I'll try and bring it back to you here. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Should have some content to bring you in the next couple weeks. This weekend, going to the New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting in Liberty Corner. Larry Connor is going to be the featured speaker. They're going to have a mix of speaker and hands-on there, so that should be a lot of fun. Following weekend, or the 2 weeks from now, I guess, is the Beekeepers Association meeting for the Northwest Branch, which I belong to. We're going to do fall management there and a couple other things. We have some exciting times coming up for us because the Northwest New Jersey branch, of which I am an officer, is going to host the spring meeting next year for the state level. Chances are we'll be up at Snyder Research Farm in Pittstown, New Jersey, and we're starting to get together the plans for that. So we have to find a speaker, find topics to cover, both on the hands-on and a lot of planning coming up for that. So that'll be an interesting period to talk about. Maybe we'll take you through some of that in case you have some planning of your own to do for an event. And certainly we're going to get ourselves prepped for winter here, so we'll have a couple more topics to close down the season. And we appreciate you coming in and listening to the podcast, and we'll catch you next time. Our website, www.bkcorner.org, or you can reach us through email, kevin@bkcorner.org. Drop us a line, let us know how things are going for you this beekeeping season. We'd be happy to hear from you. If you do chat with us, please let us know how to say your name, and we'll possibly give you a shout out here on the podcast. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.